The Butsudan. Hiroshi-san died at the start of the new year. Now, 9 months later, it is the beginning of Obon, the festival of the dead in Japan, and he is due to come home for a visit. As I trudge back from the market, I can sense the happy excitement and anticipation of the people around me, many of them already wearing yukatas, the lightweight summer kimonos, in preparation for the dancing that will start tonight. But all I feel is a profound, stomach-turning dread. As a Westerner, I don't share the Japanese belief, based in Buddhist legend, that the dead are allowed to leave the underworld to visit once a year, that they are guided back to their earthly homes by bonfires and candles. And yet, this morning I took extra care as I arranged the little bowls of dumplings and noodles on the Butsudan, the family altar where the ancestors are worshipped. I set sake and plum wine on the second shelf and arranged a mixture of chopped eggplant, rice, and cucumber on a lotus leaf beside it. I played the pious hostess preparing the symbolic feast. Despite myself, I thought of my dead husband and murmured a brief prayer that, if there should be an afterlife, it finds him well and happy. I doubt it. Hiroshi-san was as stingy with a kind word or a smile as he was with the small allowance of yen he doled out to me every week. He was a dour and miserly man in life. In death, why should he be different? The festivities are already starting in the town park, where the Banodori, the traditional dances, will take place. A young man climbs the platform in the center of the dance space and begins pounding a taiko drum. I see families lugging coolers filled with beer, iced tea, and shaved ice. It is the hottest time of the year. As I pass the torii gate that marks the entrance to the Shinto shrine up the hill, some children scamper past me. One of them, a little girl with jet hair and huge black eyes, stops to gape at me, then hurls the one word I learned very quickly upon coming to Japan. "Gaijin!" she shrieks, and points at me. "Gaijin! Gaijin!" Foreigner. A woman, apparently the girl's mother, grabs the child's hand and yanks her along, but the girl stares back at me over her shoulder, taking in my yellow hair and green eyes, as one would an exotic butterfly pinned to a board. It has happened so many times, you'd think I would get used to it, but I never do. I was married to Hiroshi-san for 5 years, but still I am a stranger here, still an object of curiosity, my height and coloring an invitation to stare, my halting attempts to speak the language ever a source of bewilderment and amusement. It wasn't supposed to be like this. When I came to Japan to marry Hiroshi-san, shortly after meeting him at an art gallery in Chicago where I worked as a receptionist, I imagined an exotic, romantic life in a foreign land. I envisioned tea ceremonies and no dramas, zen gardens where red-lipped, kimono-clad geisha performed classical dance. What I got were bitter winters and steaming summers, gangs of sullen teenagers with spiked hair and iPods, subways full of salarymen who leered first at me and then at their porno mangas, and a language as incomprehensible as the chattering of crickets on a summer morning. And along with that, side by side with the kitschy and the profane, an astonishing array of festivals that link the human and the divine, all aimed at invoking the goodwill of the deities and ancestors. Now Obon. Already I can see fires burning, candles flickering in windows and on porches, bonfires tended by bare-armed, sweaty men on open lawns and along the riverbanks. People stand in their open doorways, silent reception committees for their spectral guests. Fireworks explode on every corner, and squealing, giggling children wave glowing pinwheels in the darkening air. The heat is stifling, suffocating, full of smoke from the fires and the fireworks. Sweat pours down my face and puddles between my breasts. There is no heat in the world like the heat of a Japanese August. It clings to the skin like a hot, damp rag and pastes the hair to the scalp. In such a swelter, all movements seem to require extra effort. In this world, supposedly a swarm with ghosts, it feels as though everything is underwater, that I wade along the path as much as walk. When I reach the wooden house, known as a minka, that I once shared with my husband, I see a pair of men's brown Gucci loafers outside the door, and know that Katsuro-san, Hiroshi-san's son, has come to honor his father and the other ancestors. I leave my sandals beside his shoes, only the dead wear shoes indoors, and put on a pair of slippers before I slide back the door and go inside. Even in the smaller towns, a traditional house like this, with tatami mats on the floors and shoji screens dividing the rooms, with bedding that is rolled and stored in a cupboard during the day and unrolled at night, and a hearth for making fires in the winter, is a rarity. In the older minkas, the roof is thatched, but ours is tile, the ends of the tiles decorated with images of deities thought to provide protection. The butsudan, or spirit cabinet, with its intricately carved lotus leaves and sutras, occupies a grand alcove in the largest of the rooms. It is the first thing one sees upon entering the house. This butsudan, handed down through Hiroshi-san's family through generations, is a massive, imposing cabinet made of cherry and cedar wood, hived with a multitude of alcoves and cabinets and cubicles, in which to store the dishes, incense, candles, and writing implements, which are part of the daily rituals. A gold Buddha rests at the top, presiding over the many shelves and a desk that folds out for copying Buddhist texts. I call out to Katsuro-san, but apparently he doesn't hear me over the raucous babble of a game show blaring from the TV set in the back of the house. I find this annoying, but not as much so as the fact that Katsuro-san has lit the candles on the butsudan, then left them unattended, a dangerous practice on a sultry evening with a hot breeze coming through the windows. But then, where money or pleasure's not concerned, Katsuro-san isn't one for details. After Hiroshi-san died, Katsuro-san spent less time grieving than he did visiting banks, exploring the possibility of land deeds, overseas funds, secret stock portfolios. In his younger days, as an importer of antiques and art, Hiroshi-san had reputedly amassed a fortune, not all of it honestly made. Some of his associates were art smugglers and forgers. A few were members of the feared Yakuza, Japanese organized crime. Then, after his first wife died, Hiroshi-san apparently woke up to the brevity and fragility of life. He renounced his criminal connections, left Tokyo for this small town in eastern Kyushu, and became a fervent meditator and student of the sutras. After a few cups of sake, he often boasted of a fortune hidden away, but in reality he lived a life of almost obsessive frugality, deeming even the most minor luxury a reckless extravagance. Katsuro-san remains convinced a secret fortune exists, if only it could be found, but so far nothing has turned up. In Hiroshi-san's will, I was left the house and a meager stipend of cash, and Katsuro-san, whose profligacy with money was a constant source of embarrassment and outrage to his father, got even less. Not enough for either of us to live comfortably. Certainly not enough to leave Japan. As I'm frowning at the candles on the butsudan, I notice something else. Katsuro-san has placed fresh flowers on the bottom shelf, and, next to that, an exquisite porcelain bowl filled with dark red liquid. I dip a finger into it and touch it to my lips. In the overheaded room, cold travels up my spine like an unwelcome kiss. Carolyn-san? I look up to see Katsuro-san watching me from the doorway. He's taller than most Japanese, with regal cheekbones and a thin mouth that always looks ready to leave teeth marks in something. I walk across the room, and we bow to each other formally, me dipping a bit lower, as is customary with women. Good evening, Katsuro-san. Good evening, Carolyn-san. The smallest of smiles, like the flick of a whip, crosses Katsuro-san's mouth. Then we are in each other's arms, kissing, grabbing each other like starving people finding food, his hands tangled in my hair, inside my blouse, my fingers working at the button of his trousers. Suddenly he pushes me away. No, we can't. Not at Oban. It's disrespectful. Such things have seldom concerned Katsuro-san before. His very wantonness has always been the greatest source of his appeal. With the spell of our union broken, my irritation returns quickly. Why did you light the candles if you were going to watch TV? And what the hell was the idea of putting this on the altar? I show him the bowl of thick red liquid. He shrugs. Red bean soup, so what? I haven't prepared red bean soup since Hiroshi-san died. Did you think it was clever to offer it for Oban? I didn't put it there. Then how? Maybe one of the relatives or neighbors stopped by while you were out. He takes the small dish, lifts it to his mouth, and drains it. There, all gone. What is it, Carolyn-san? Are you afraid of bean soup now? It wasn't bean soup that killed my father. He choked to death on mochi. It was an accident. You know that. Do I? Is he testing me? I try to read his expression, but but inscrutable is not an adjective applied to the Japanese for nothing. It's oban, he continues, and you feel guilty, so your mind is playing tricks. It's understandable. But what happened between us didn't really begin until after Father died. It isn't like we were sneaking off to love hotels behind his back. No, we sneak off to love hotels now, in Beppu, a larger city up the coast. It would not look good before the neighbors if Katsuro-san spent too much time here, and the three Meiji brothers, who live across the street and raise silkworms, are ever at their windows. So Katsuro-san comes and goes with utmost discretion, often living in a tiny apartment he keeps in an adjacent town. Blow out the candles before you go to bed, I tell him sourly as I leave the room. Fine, he says. And by the way, I didn't light them. We sleep in separate rooms that night, or try to sleep at least. The fireworks explode till well past midnight. The taiko drums pound like punishing blows. I'm wet all over, furious at Katsuro-san, yet at the same time longing to pull him against me, inside me. He lied about the candles and the red bean soup. Or did he? Was it intended as a joke? If so, it was a cruel one. No, it wasn't red bean soup that killed Hiroshi-san, but the sticky rice cakes, called mochi, that were in the bean soup. It's a traditional New Year's dish, mochi and red bean soup, eaten for good luck. Ironically, it sometimes brings death rather than good fortune. When baked, the mochi becomes extremely sticky and almost impossible to chew. Every year, several elderly people suffocate when the mochi they are eating gets stuck in their windpipes, but every year those seeking good luck ignore the danger. At 2 a.m., unable to sleep, I get up from the futon. My intention is to go to Katsuro-san's room, crawl into his futon, and make him forget the ancestors. Then I realize he must have had the same idea, because he's standing in the doorway, holding a candle, watching me. Except it isn't Katsuro-san. Hiroshi-san regards me with a stricken stare. The candle flame illuminates the shifting shadows from which his face emerges. His mouth gapes and he gasps for air. His voice is the painful sound of a dull knife scraping bone. Hell, he rasps. I am in hell. Then he lifts the candle to his lips and drinks the flame. The fire blazes behind his eyes, giving his wizened face a fierce, demonic countenance. He reaches out for me. I scream, and he is gone. The next day, members of Hiroshi-san's extended family come to visit and pay their respects before the butsudan. I tend the candles and the incense, make sure the food is ample and the sake flows, as aunties and uncles and cousins make their obligatory appearance, bowing deeply before they begin their prayers, engaging Katsuro-san in endless conversation of which I am made no part. Hiroshi-san's family, especially Katsuro-san, resent the fact that in all these years I've been unable to learn anything beyond the simplest Japanese. They do not appreciate how difficult their language is, how unnatural the construction of their sentences, as though they set out to build a house but did it upside down, the roof being laid down first, followed by the stories in reverse order, then the floor and finally the basement. They don't understand that reading the characters, the katakana, hiragana, and kanji, is like trying to follow a backwards road map drawn by a blind man and held up to a mirror. What did you talk about? I ask Katsuro-san, when the last one finally slips on their shoes and takes their leave. He gives me the small, sardonic grin of a man who takes for granted his own superiority in all matters. If you'd only study your Japanese, you wouldn't have to ask. Ignoring the barb, I press on. Last night, I begin tentatively, I dreamed I saw Hiroshi-san. He was eating fire. He said he was in hell. A dream, that's all, replies Katsuro-san. Remember the tradition I told you about, of how oban began? You were thinking of it, that's all. The legend goes that one of Buddha's foremost disciples learned his mother had been reborn in hell and couldn't eat, because anything she brought to her mouth would turn to fire. To save her, he was advised to offer food to the monks following their mid-August retreat. The mother was saved, and thus oban began. I nod, but remain unconvinced. I may be just a gaijin, but I know what I saw. We should have left here before oban. This house is worth a little money, and you have some savings. The muscles of Katsuro-san's jaw clench like a fist. Not until I find where father put the fortune he always bragged about. He makes a karate-chopping motion with his hand for emphasis. I know we'll talk no more about it. While Katsuro-san goes to make the obligatory Oban visit to the cemetery, I put fresh flowers on the butsudan and light more incense and candles. The cup of sake on the top shelf looks appealing. To hell with thirsty ancestors. I gulp it down. A quiver ascends my spine as the strong drink slides down my throat. I feel a wave of dizziness and reach a hand out for the cushion to steady myself. In this stifling room, where despite the breeze, the heat has gathered and intensified throughout the day, the pillow is as cold as if it had just come from a freezer. I watch as the pale smoke from the incense and the candles trails upward and intertwines, gray yin and dark blue yang, a mating of disparate energies. Hiroshi-san's contorted face stares out from within the smoke like a face peering in through smudged glass. He's smoke himself at first, and then he isn't. Now shreds of flesh, now thread thin curls of smoke. The candle flame licks through his phantom flesh like a second searing tongue. I blink and flinch away, convinced that I'm hallucinating. But when I dare to look again, the apparition is still there. He shudders, undulating like an image reflecting in a pool of water where someone has tossed a stone. My wife, forever. I can feel that scraping bone voice as it rattles its way up my spine. Mine. What do you want, Hiroshi-san? My wife. Your duty to the dead. Duty to the dead? What does that mean? Where I come from, in America, we do not venerate the ancestors. They are the foreshadowing of what we too shall be. We do not want to look. We bury them and then move on. To other cities, other states, sometimes to other countries. The past dies and it is gone, erased from time, forgotten. Not here, though. Not in Japan, and certainly not at Oban. The living here are ever captive to the dead. Hiroshi-san's gray, evanescent hands wave toward the butsudan. Clean it, he groans. Honor the butsudan. You honor me. You free me from this hell. Hiroshi-san, he opens his gaping, flame-filled mouth. Wife, do what I say. In the overheated room, a deep chill descends. Suddenly, I am shivering violently, and the small meal I had for breakfast lurches toward my throat. I fetch water, polish, and cleaning rags and set to work. The butsudan already gleams, but now I clean it more thoroughly, running the cleaning rag up into every nook and hidey-hole, exploring the junctures where the boards are fitted together, removing the tiniest speck of dust from the creases of the Buddha's robe. The butsudan has a roof on top, in the manner of a Buddhist temple. Gold paint outlines the ornate filigrees and arabesques that, generations ago, some unknown craftsman carved into the handsome wood. I polish and dust the outer shelves, then reach inside to get at the very back. I can't see the characters carved into the wooden panel on the inner seam of the butsudan's roof, but I feel them there and trace them with my fingers. At first I think it's just more decoration, but the location is in a place where no one would ever see it, unless, like me, they made a pretzel of their spine to get at it with a dust rag. There are two characters carved into the wood, and below that a thin ridge where two boards meet unevenly. I fetch a mirror and hold a candle in an attempt to see the characters, but they are too far back, too tiny. I get a paper and a pencil with thick, soft lid, and, leaning so far back I feel like a contortionist, I make a rubbing of the characters. Katsuro-san is just returning from the cemetery. Although I want to run to him at once to ask the meaning of what I found, I realize there is something else I must do first. Besides, I am afraid to know the truth, afraid of what I may learn. Later that evening, when I hand him the rubbing, he frowns and studies it. What's this? It was carved under the roof of the butsudan. What does it mean? He shakes his head as though profoundly saddened by my Western ignorance. If you only would learn Japanese, you could read these yourself. Are you going to tell me what it means or not? It's nothing, he says. Just the signature of the artist who carved the butsudan, that's all. But in such an odd place. That's all it is. Really, Carolyn-san, what did you expect? What did I expect, indeed? The disappointment and hurt takes my breath away, as though I've been kicked in the chest. Despite his sarcasm and subtle disdain for me as his father's gaijin wife, I wanted Katsuro-san since the first time I saw him, since the first time his hand accidentally brushed my hip as we passed in a hallway, the first time he held my gaze a moment longer than is proper. With Hiroshi-san dead, I've dreamed of leaving here with him and starting a new life far from Japan, far from a language I can't understand, and the endless veneration of centuries' worth of ancestors. For a moment I am silent, absorbing what Katsuro-san has told me, listening to the distant throbbing of the drums. I smile as warmly as I can and take his hand. The Banodori is starting. We should take part. He looks bemused. I thought you didn't like these foreign dances. At least we'll be outside in the fresh air. Change into your yukata. Come on. While Katsuro-san is changing, I put more food upon the altar, remove the wilted flowers, and light fresh candles and incense, as Hiroshi-san has told me to do. I feel certain that his ghost observes me and is pleased, that in some way I cannot understand, it is my destiny to honor his spirit in this fashion. On any other night, the sight of Hiroshi-san's son and myself walking together might raise eyebrows, but at Oban it is only fitting that families reunite, both the living and the dead. At any rate, we are soon lost in the streams of people heading toward the Buddhist temple beside the river. The priest has climbed up into the bell tower and begun to strike the bell, the oldest in the prefecture of Fukuoka. We walk past bonfires ablaze, and children holding folded pieces of colored paper, playing a game that involves using paper spoons to try to scoop goldfish from a tub before the paper gets wet and rips. In the sticky heat of evening, almost everyone has changed into brightly colored yukatas with bold geometric designs. Fireworks explode, dogs howl and yap. The beating of the taiko drums is frantic, pounding. Katsuro-san and I push our way into the dance, where dozens of people are already whirling madly. Four concentric circles, revolving one around the other, the brilliantly colored yukatas blowing and billowing, like a giant kaleidoscope being twirled. The Banodori dances vary from town to town, but all depict some local theme or story. Hand gestures mime activities like digging or cutting rice, or the gentle flowing of rivers. As more people join in, the circle expands, then doubles back on itself like a snake eating its own tail, the dancers moving around a central platform festooned with crepe paper. The air is dense and musky with sweat and incense and the smoke from the bonfires. Long past the point of exhaustion, we still keep up the hypnotic, trance-inducing pace. The ghosts returned for Oban celebrate among us. Their spectral bodies pulse in rhythm with the drumming. They are with us, the land of the dead, superimposed over the land of the living, caught up in an endless, unseen mating dance of sweaty mortal flesh and the wraith vestiges of the departed. The faster and harder we dance, the more clearly I can see them. Like a shimmering mist, they mass along the road between the bonfires, avid for the memory of a time when they were, as we are now, possessed of mortal flesh and human lust and joy and greed. Their hunger, like our own, is vast and insatiable. It is the hunger of the dead for what they have lost, the hunger of the living for one more taste of what they will inevitably lose. I can feel my own death, whether it comes tonight or 30 years from now, like teeth upon my throat. Come with me, I call to Katsuro-san, and when he turns to me, I see the same wild hunger in his face, the greed for life and more life. It is the first time in so long that we have looked into each other's eyes and really seen each other. We pull free of the whirling mob, fight our way through the outer circle of dancers. A stone bridge leans across a deep pond filled with koi to a temple dedicated to the scholar and calligrapher Tenjin. We cross the bridge and duck underneath where the shadows are deep and no light penetrates. Katsuro-san sits with his back against the stone arch, opens his yukata, and guides me down on top of him. Above us the drums are pounding, the dancers' feet stomping out the beat, voices raised in song. The urgent sounds Katsuro-san and I are making go unheard. It's after midnight as we walk back through the temple complex to the house, our sweat-soaked yukatas clinging to our bodies. My hair is plastered to my face in a damp cap. Fireworks still explode intermittently, and ashes drift in the air from the fires. In the deep darkness, where no one can see us, Katsuro-san slides his arm around my waist, and kisses me as silent tears stream down my face. In his embrace, I start to have a change of heart. I decide to tell him that I know the truth about the writing inside the Butsudan. In the heat and passion of our coupling, I have, for a moment, the wild hope that there still might be a future for us, that underneath our lies and pretenses, we could still make a life together. I think of the riches Hiroshi-san claimed to have stashed away, and the life of ease and prosperity Katsuro-san and I could enjoy if we could only find them. "Katsuro-san," I begin, "I have to tell you something." But as we round the corner and head back to the house, there's a terrible and ungodly sight. For a moment, I imagine that the Meiji brothers across the street have lit a bonfire, although their yard is even tinier than ours, and to do so would put the entire block in danger. Katsuro-san cries out in anguish and breaks into a run. I wail like a madwoman, "Wait, don't go inside! There's nothing there!" He doesn't hear, or if he does, my words mean nothing to him. Still pleading with him to stop, I run behind him, but Katsuro-san is already at the door. He heaves it open and plunges inside. Through the thick smoke, I get a glimpse of flaming shoji screens. It occurs to me if any ghosts are still adrift to the Soban, they will be lost no longer. Our blazing minka is a gigantic milestone of flame and fury. Two firemen hauling a hose yell at me in Japanese and shoulder me aside. I glimpse Katsuro-san's writhing silhouette for just an instant before a burning beam cuts short his screams. I don't see Katsuro-san again, but I see his father. Hiroshi-san's phantom form takes shape amid the smoke and cinders. Soot frames his smile, and ashes cling to him like scales. A look of vengeful satisfaction contorts his face. In a grim and terrifying way, he looks well pleased. Unlike Katsuro-san, the Butsudan, along with most of the house, survived the blaze. Our ever-vigilant neighbors, the Meiji brothers, had seen the flames and called for help. Then they rushed into the house to save the one thing that any Japanese would know is valued above all else. The Butsudan sat safely on the lawn where the Meiji men had carried it, while Katsuro-san was searching for it in vain amid the smoke and flames. For nothing. Like his father, Katsuro-san underestimated me. It's true I failed to learn much Japanese, and my attempts to speak are still pitifully inept. But I can use a kanji dictionary well enough to know that he was lying when he told me the words carved into the Butsudan with a craftsman's signature. What I found were the characters for discovery and prosperity, and in the hidden compartment behind them was a key that I removed before I ever tested Katsuro-san's loyalty by asking him their meaning. The key was inside an envelope, and on it, in both Japanese and English, were instructions. On the last day of Oban, while Katsuro-san's body is being held awaiting a final burning in the crematorium, I take the key to the Buddhist temple and wait while an officious young monk scurries to find the priest. The priest is a portly, broad-faced man with a bald dome and a belly that would do credit to Gotama himself. When he learns that I'm Hiroshi-san's widow, his smile expands like the wings of a pink bird unfolding, and he bows ever more deeply. "Yes, yes," he says, beckoning me. He leads me to his office at the back of the temple and presents me with a carved lacquered box. "Hiroshi-san was a generous and pious man," he says. "Over the years he gave a fortune to the temple, but he never wanted anyone to know. Merit comes from anonymous giving," he used to say. "Hiroshi-san entrusted this to me. He told me you would come for it one day. He said he would make sure you learned of it." At last, I think, this is what it all was for. But when I open up the box, there is only this, a small porcelain bowl, in it a tiny ball of mochi. And I remember New Year's Day, when I prepared the mochi in the sweet bean soup, cooking it till it was soft and rubbery. Katsuro-san had left the house. I came to Hiroshi-san while he was napping, his mouth open, snoring. Almost lovingly, like a mother bird feeding its young, I popped a thick piece of mochi into his mouth. His next snore sucked it down. When his eyes opened in surprise and fear, I clamped my hands across his mouth. The mochi plugged his windpipe. That New Year's Day, he was among four other elderly Japanese men who died eating mochi for good luck. A tragedy all too preventable, the newspapers predictably pointed out. It is the last night of Oban when I walk down to the river to watch the final ceremony. Candles are being lit and set in little paper boats to float downstream from the river to the sea, guiding the departing spirits back to the land of the dead. As I watch the parade of lights stretching out to the horizon, I know that I will remain here in Japan, that I will tend the butsudan, put out the offerings of rice and pour the sake and plum wine, that I am the keeper of the ancestors, guardian of the ghosts of my dead husband and dead lover. You are still my wife, Hiroshi-san said. I know that he is right. One day the candles in their little boats will mark the way for me. One day my spirit will follow them, traveling to my own destiny in the land of the dead. And when Oban comes around, I will return with all the other ghosts to remember what I've lost.